Right, it's now 10:30, so I think we'll make a start so that we can try and make the most of the time we have in this room before we have to leave at 12. First of all, welcome everybody to this morning seminar and presentation, which is jointly organised by Global Strategy Forum, of which I'm Michael Logan, I'm the chairman, and CSOC from Oxford, the Southeastern European Studies at Oxford, centred at St Anthony's College. This is the second time we've actually done something jointly together, and I hope it'll be an interesting morning. We're looking at, under the title Bosnia and Herzegovina, New International Thinking, we're looking at a report on a workshop organised by CSOCs in association with the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Oxford and LSEE Research on Southeast Europe, the London School of Economics and Political Science. So there's been a lot of work put into this report. We have five speakers this morning who I will ask to make presentations about various aspects of the report. That will take us to 11:20, and then we'll have 40 minutes in which we can ask questions, make comments, and generally take this forward. So I know that you've all had the biographies of our speakers, so I'm not going to go into them in detail, but if I could just very quickly introduce them. On my immediate right, Professor Richard Kaplan, who's the Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford. Next to him, Dr. James Kerr Lindsay, Eurobank Senior Research Fellow on the Politics of Southeast Europe at the European Institute at the London School of Economics and Political Science. On my immediate left, Dr. Othon Anastasakis, who's Director of Southeast European Studies at Oxford, that's CSOCs, and Director of the European Studies Centre at St Anthony's College. Next to him is Jesse Pronasova, a DPhil candidate in politics at St Anthony's College, Oxford. And on my far left, Sir David Madden, former ambassador, who's chairman of the CSOCs Development Committee. So that is our panel this morning. You will hear from each of them, as I say, in turn, after which I will open it to a discussion. I'm going to start on my immediate right with Professor Richard Kaplan. Would you like to lead us off this morning?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lord Lothian. Thank you all for coming this morning. I thought it might be useful if I say a few words of background with respect to this forum, this meeting today, and the event that preceded it. On January 30th of this year, CSOC, Southeast European Studies at Oxford, and the LSEE Research on Southeastern Europe organized a day-long workshop that brought together leading international policymakers and analysts to discuss Bosnia-Herzegovina. It was international only, and that was very deliberate because we thought that it would be more conducive to a free-flowing discussion without constraint about the situation in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And indeed, the purpose was threefold of that workshop. First, to take stock of the current situation, political, economic, and social, in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Secondly, to identify the main obstacles to the progress of reforms there. And third, to suggest possible ways forward. And more broadly, the aim was to identify ways of enhancing the effectiveness of international engagement in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The discussion conducted under Chatham House rule was open, frank, and wide-ranging. And what we're proposing to do today is to present some of the thoughts, anonymized, of course, that emerged from the workshop. And this is the first public forum on the workshop since it was held, as I said, at the end of January. Now, while I'm sure you can imagine it's difficult to generalize about the views of so large and diverse a group of experts as those who gathered in Oxford on the 30th, but I would suggest that there were two dominant, though seemingly contradictory, impressions on the day. On the one hand, a recognition that for all the problems and challenges that plague Bosnia and Herzegovina, and they are serious, there has nonetheless been significant progress from the beginning of international engagement there after the war in pulling the country back from the brink of destruction and towards a future which lies with and within the European Union. But on the other hand, there was also a very strong sense among the participants that we've reached a genuine fork in the road, in the sense that Bosnia-Herzegovina cannot continue to be buoyed artificially, indefinitely, and that new approaches to break the current stalemate are required. The day-long workshop was divided into four panels. The first was on the current situation. The second was on political, security sector, and constitutional reform. The third was on economic development, and the fourth was on social relations. The first was devoted, as I said, to taking stock of the current situation, and I would like to report on that, and the other panelists will report on the discussion relating to the other panels on the day. That first session examined the following questions. What are the main policy areas where the international actors have succeeded in bringing about change and reform? Where have they failed? What can we learn from the past, and what can we do better? Now, these are large questions, all of them, and I'll provide you with just a few select highlights of that discussion. So what explains the continuing impasse? Factors were identified at all levels, national, regional, and international. Internally, there's been only limited political will among the top echelons to make progress on reforms that would strengthen the central state and enhance its functionality. The Bosnian Serb leader, Milorad Dodik, continually threatens to call a referendum on independence for Republika Srpska. Meanwhile, many within the Bosnian Croat leadership have been pressing the case for the creation of a third entity, and Bosniaks arguably have been insensitive to the concerns of the Bosnian Croat and Bosnian Serb communities. So insufficient political will among the top echelons. But the underlying causes for the reluctance of political leaders to reform and effectively move closer to the European Union are not merely based on nationalism. Over the past 20 years, party leaders have created close-knit clans and have accumulated significant power and resources. So politics in Bosnia, to an extent, have been reduced to squabbles over competence and turf in the form of competition for the control of public resources. And it's clear that reforms would threaten the hold of entrenched political elites, and they know it. And this is one of the very clear reasons why they resist. Leaders also fear that a frank commitment to the EU path would uncover their corrupt behavior and possibly lead to their criminal prosecution. So there's thus little incentive for them to support reforms. The regional dynamics have also played an important role in impeding progress. For various reasons, Bosnia's progress is tied with developments in both Serbia and Croatia, as well as the wider West Balkan region. And while Croatia has entered the EU in 2013, and Serbia now has candidate status, conditions, situation in those countries have not provided the necessary impetus to bring Bosnia farther along. So they have not been encouraging and supportive. And internationally, the failure of international organizations to provide consistent guidance and leadership has been a problem. There's been a lack of genuine perspective for membership in the EU and NATO. This, combined with misplaced and unduly strict conditionality, have reduced the credibility of international efforts to bring Bosnia-Herzegovina closer and eventually into both organizations. Now, I want to remind you again, these were the views that were expressed at the meeting. These are not my views necessarily, or the views of any of us here today necessarily, although a number of these views do resonate. But trying just to give you a sense of the sentiment that emerged from the discussion on the day. Despite the gravity of the situation in Bosnia. It was also thought that it's necessary to maintain a sense of guarded optimism and purpose, because, as I said at the outset, much has been achieved in the past 20 years, certainly compared with many other post-war countries, Iraq, Afghanistan, among many others. Bosnia has not been as much of a failure as is often presented. The strong approach that Paddy Ashdown took proved to be very effective at the time. He introduced a single tax system, which kept Bosnia fiscally afloat because of its effective indirect taxing. Elections have been fairly peaceful, organized by the Bosnians themselves, and very radical parties have not fared well in those elections. So, broadly speaking, more moderate parties have been elected to power. These terms are all relative, of course, to the context. Defense reform has progressed well. The security sector achieved structural changes, a lot of this through coherent international tutelage. So this is an area where international guidance has been very effective, resulting in a single border police, a single state intelligence agency, and a single national army. Bosnia now has its own Partnership for Peace Training Center, which is quite significant. In this sense, as it was observed, it is a provider of security and not just a consumer of security. And another sign of success is that finally, after a torturous process lasting 24 years, a census is being carried out, the results of which could have important consequences for a variety of regulations and institutions. Moreover, looking ahead, there is still a strong wish within Bosnia to join the EU. Depending on the polling data, around 90% of Bosniaks and even as high as 75% of Bosnian Serbs support entry into the EU. And this is a primary incentive that can be used to drive further reform. So overall, the assessment's been that there has been both success and failure, and that the latter shouldn't be exaggerated at the expense of the former. The important thing is to see and understand how successes have been achieved and to try to learn from this process. And in that vein, at the conclusion of the day, we identified a number of lessons that we can learn from the experience. And I should say, incidentally, that the report of the workshop will be available publicly fairly soon, so you'll be able to read an account of the day. But I'll just highlight three lessons that were drawn from this first session. One is that advancing EU membership is the single most important task at this stage. Experience has shown that the closer that a state moves to the EU, the more willing it is to accept difficult changes and compromises. But in parallel, we should revive the good work of drawing Bosnia closer to NATO, especially through reinvigorating the membership action plan, MAP. Secondly, political conditionality should be used, but very carefully and sparingly. Tying the NATO or EU accession process to a very narrow issue or issues, as happened with respect to the Sejdić-Finci case and also military properties in the case of NATO, it was thought to be counterproductive and only providing spoilers with a chance to block integration. And finally, for purposes anyway of this first session, that one of the ways to encourage Bosnia to move towards the EU and NATO is by integrating the rest of the Balkans. Fix the region, fix NATO, fix Bosnia, that was the message, one of the messages on the day, and also to find a way of integrating the diaspora communities in a more positive and constructive manner. So as I said, these are highlights of the first of four sessions, and my colleagues will report on those other sessions momentarily.
Thank you very much, Professor Kaplan. I'm going to move straight on and ask Dr. Kerr Lindsay if he will take on from there and report on the other session.
Thank you very much, Lord Lothian, and thank you to Global Strategy Forum, Jacqueline, for all the effort putting this together. As Richard just identified, I mean, we all know that there are a significant range of problems that we face with Bosnia. The second session, the session which I will report on, was actually an attempt to try and look at some of the ways that we might overcome the impasse that we've reached on a number of major reform issues. It's very clear in speaking to all the officials that any significant progress on reform has been stalled now for really a decade. It is that long. That there have been a number of serious issues that have come to the forefront which just simply haven't been tackled. And I think the most obvious one that springs to mind, of course, is Sejdić Finci. For anyone who might not be aware, this is a major case that came before the European Court of Human Rights, which dealt with the example of two citizens of Bosnia, one who from the Jewish community and one from the Roma community, who took a case to the European Court of Human Rights about the fact that they weren't eligible to stand for senior positions within the state on the basis of their current affiliation, that they actually had to be identified as a Croat, a Serb or a Bosniak in order to stand, and the court actually said that this was actually contrary to human rights and that there needed to be substantial reform that would be, and constitutional reform that would take place, which would remedy this situation and allow people who didn't identify with one of the three main communities to be able to assume senior positions. This has become a major headache for the European Union. It's tried on a number of times to try and overcome this deadlock. And eventually, for anyone who was following the situation, essentially the European Union, it would say it didn't give up. But what it did is it took a decision that they're going to park this issue for the meanwhile and focus on reform in other areas. They've been very clear that this is not something that's going to just simply disappear altogether. It needs to be dealt with. As you will all be aware, adherence to ECHR rulings is actually it's actually required for EU membership. So, in effect, Bosnia will not be able to join the European Union until such time as this issue is resolved. But I think the feeling was that really came out was that too much attention had been given to this. And what it meant was that spoilers in the process had actually used this as a mechanism for holding up Bosnia's EU accession. And that progress in all sorts of other areas had also been prevented as a result of this. And so the European Union, working mainly through a major initiative which was launched by the British and the German governments, have actually decided to approach things as what they call resequencing the process of reform. And so much more attention will now be given on economic issues, on social reform, in order to help improve the lives of ordinary Bosnian citizens as much as possible in the period ahead. As I say, parking the issue of major constitutional reform. I won't talk about the economic aspects because that will I believe, Othon, we'll tackle that in the next presentation. But what I will do for the remainder of my presentation is sort of just give some pointers as to how the members of the international organisations who were present at the event felt that reform could be tackled, given that it has been such a torturous process for the best part of the last 10 years. The good news, as they saw it, is that it is still possible to achieve reform. Although it took place in a rather different era, the example that was highlighted was the major reform that allowed for a single Bosnian armed forces to emerge. This was seen as an incredibly important development, that it was an example of where the three major communities were able to reach an agreement and integrate their armed forces. In that particular case, the success was attributed to the fact that it was very professionally planned. It was a very clear, straightforward end goal to reach. And there was a number of very technical requirements that were put in place, which I think sort of was seen to have served this purpose and make it actually far more effective and efficient, that there was less room for political manoeuvring over this. As a result, Bosnia, as Richard mentioned, now has taken part in international missions. But it isn't job complete yet. That NATO membership has been held up as a result of continued bickering. And in actual fact, the figures from the two parts, the two entities, if you like, in Bosnia are actually very stark in revealing just the sense in favour and against NATO membership. So in the Federation, support for NATO membership is currently running at about 80%. In Republika Srpska, it's just at 16%. But of course, as one can point out. There may be room to change that depending on developments in Serbia. If Serbia shows any indication of wanting to move closer to NATO, then there is a sense that this could actually improve matters. But just as an aside, a few months ago, the Deputy Defence Minister of Bosnia was speaking here in London, and actually it was rather surprising to hear how much she was, as a Bosnian Serb, was in favour of NATO membership. So it's clear that even within the Serbian community there are those who do strongly favour it. On the downside, we've also seen examples of where reform has been very badly handled, and I think the example that often springs to mind and was certainly used in the case of the workshop was police reform. This was an attempt to try and integrate police forces. The biggest mistake that was made in that case was that there was an attempt to try and persuade the Bosnians that this was something that was required as part of EU membership. It doesn't take a lot to find out that there is no one-size-fits-all police system within the European Union, that each country, even provinces, have fundamentally different forms of policing, and that this has now become a very clear model for how not to conduct reform. Do not tell lies effectively. You will be found out, and then it undermines the credibility of any further reform efforts. Because next time you say, well, you need to do this for the European Union, the parties say, yes, this is what you told us about police reform. It wasn't the case. You know, are you doing the same this time? So I think it's extremely important that any attempt to introduce reform must be very carefully handled and must be very honestly handled with the parties. As was also mentioned, I mean, the problem is we're dealing with a very poor political environment. There's incredible resistance to change from political classes, many of which are extremely fearful of what the consequences of those changes will mean for them personally. They've seen examples in neighbouring countries. I think Croatia is the best example, where senior politicians have been thrown in jail for corruption. These are people who are sincerely worried that if major reforms take place, that they could then find themselves thrown in jail as well or subject to investigation. And so for all of these reasons, I think, that there has been a sense that the international community, one, needs to engage much more actively on the reform process. The British-German initiative is widely seen as a very good example of this, some sort of greater re-engagement, but also needs to think very intelligently about how it approaches reform. And I think, again, that this is something that we've seen, a need to focus on things that matter to people on the ground most. And, for anyone who's spent any time in Bosnia, the economic situation is absolutely dire. That people, this really needs to be an area that a lot of attention is put into, a lot of focus, building up economic capacity. Again, I won't talk much more about that. But also to think about sort of the specific reforms that are required for EU accession. So leaving aside the major constitutional reforms that one might like to see for improvement of state functions outside of the EU context, and instead focus on those reforms which the EU has clearly identified as necessary in order to make sure that Bosnia can assume its place within the European Union as a functioning state, can speak with a single voice where it needs to. And then a couple of other small pieces of advice, which I certainly thought were very telling. There's a huge debate between centralisation and decentralisation, and it's very often presented as an either-or, that you either suck power into Sarajevo, which is something that the Bosniak community is very keen on, or you're pulling it away to the entities or sub-regions, which is something that obviously Republika Srpska and to an increasing extent the Croat community want. But, there are ways of approaching this where you can actually decentralise at the same time as centralisation. It doesn't need to be the case that central state institutions need to be based in Sarajevo. There are obviously many options that one could explore to push them out into places like Mostar, into Banja Luka, and approach things in that way. So it isn't an either or. And then I think one of the other things was avoid giving too much legitimacy to political parties and instead focus more on the state. Not be seen every, for ambassadors, for EU officials to constantly be pandering to party leaders. This just strengthens their position. Instead, they should be meeting with ministers, with senior state officials, strengthening that it's the state that needs to be reformed and needs to be handled. And I think on a final note, one that's came out very, very strongly, is that also the international community needs to start pointing fingers much more readily. That for too long it's been too cautious about identifying people who are holding up the process of reform, that there really needs to be a sustained effort, that, you know, when a particular party leader or when a particular grouping is preventing major reform, that the international community calls them on that and points out that this is actually having wider effects, that this is holding up the EU accession process. So I think, as I say, in sum, the feeling was that, you know, no one would seek to downplay the magnitude of the problem we're facing in terms of reform, but there was a sense that, you know, with this resequencing, with focus, you know, where it needs to be, with actually being willing to challenge the political leaders, that, you know, there is still room for substantial reform in Bosnia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm now going to ask Dr. Anastasakis if you will take on from that.
Thank you very much, Lord Lothian and Jacqueline, for bringing us back here following the very successful and interesting meeting that we had last year on Serbia and Kosovo. I will continue from where James left it, because the economy is very, very important in the case of Bosnia. It does make matters worse when politics are not at a very good level. But on the other hand, it can also make matters better if it is handled in the right way. And there are definitely problems with the Bosnian economy at the moment, which are also connected to the Eurozone problems. We have to say that because Bosnia, as well as the other countries in the Balkans, in the Western Balkans, that are not members of the European Union, they have been affected by the Eurozone crisis, in that they have less foreign direct investment, and they've been very much affected by this. Now, the problems with the economy of Bosnia is that it is a transition economy, so it shares and has some similar features with the other transition economies from post-communism, but it is also a post-war economy. So you add these two kind of dimensions, and that creates a much more special situation with this country. It's a very good sign, which James mentioned as well, that there is the British-German initiative on the table. There's already been a letter to Mogherini, so that shows that there will be an interest coming from the foreign minister of the European Union, and also a focus which goes beyond the constitutional matters, the Sejdi Finci issue, not undermining it and not downgrading it, but also giving a different kind of priority on social and economic reforms in order for Bosnia as a governor to have access to EU funds, but also to unfreeze its stabilization and association process to the European Union. From a macroeconomic perspective, Bosnia is not doing that badly. It is resilient, although it has been affected by the floods of 2014. But in terms of its fiscal deficit, it is not high, so it's a low deficit, and also the external debt is under control. The things that sustain the Bosnian economy are the external remittances, because there's been a lot of there are a lot of Bosnians abroad, diasporas, that keep on bringing money back. The Bosnian economy is expected to grow at a 2.5% in 2015, so there is a positive growth expected for Bosnia. It's also assessed as a diversified economy, which focuses on timber, furniture, footwear, metallurgy, chemicals, textiles. But it also has economic potential in the fields of energy, wood industry, water industry, agribusiness, and tourism. There are, as I said, important problems that have to do with its transition that we find in other economies as well, in that it was, it has been a consumption-driven economy. There's a large public sector there, and there is low employment rate and low investment. In that sense, there were four issues that were identified by the speakers during that day. The first one was the difficulties with doing business in Bosnia, so there is a complicated business environment there to attract investment. The second one had to do with public spending. The third issue that was identified was employment, and the fourth was education. Now, regarding the business environment, there are obstacles there because there are obviously cumbersome and corrupt practices. And there are also complex administrative procedures for trading and a very poor level of infrastructure. The primary budgetary burdens were identified as an oversized government, complex bureaucratic structures, and pensions, and war-related social alliances. Bosnia has over 147 ministries and a heavy civil sector. So one can imagine how much of this budget goes to this sector and how much is spent. And then there are problems with social security where a disproportionate amount is being spent, but that also is not equally spent and not in a just kind of way. Most of it, for instance, is spent on veteran pensions and top officers who get the higher pensions, whereas lower ex-soldiers do not receive as much. Then there is also a low-quality health system and very low spending on health care. On the employment area, this is one of the major issues because unemployment rates are very, very high. The employment rate in Bosnia is very low at 40%. Youth unemployment is particularly high. And we also all know that there is a very big brain drain good minds that leave the country. It was estimated by one of the economists there that BiH, Bosnia and Herzegovina, would have to create an additional 80,000 jobs per annum to reach the European employment average by 2020. We are talking of 63% of youth over the age of 15 that are unemployed. And then next to this, which makes matters a bit more complicated, is that there is a highly clientelistic job provision system. The public sector is the main security for individuals to go to work, but that's also related to party affiliations. And because there is a social security system which is not very well advanced, those people are hung on to these jobs. Finally, the issue of education was raised in that there is a high proportion of pupils and students who are unemployed, and they come from the secondary vocational education. And this is the one that attracts 70% of people who go to school. So that's a kind of a difficult situation because they are not able to find jobs. And obviously there's very few training and requalification programs for adults to enable to move from one job to the other. So job flexibility is also very low. So the key requirements and the issues that were raised had to do with job creation, with high levels of export and investment, and in parallel, a reduction of the size of the public sector and the lessening of bureaucratic hurdles for business. There is a little bit of hope, and that's the only draft on the table at the moment, coming from the British and the German initiative. And as I said, the role of Mogherini will most probably be to focus on those kinds of socio-economic reforms and try and repeat some of the success that took place with last year with Serbia and Kosovo. That's the hope.
Thank you very much indeed. Now I'm going to ask Jessie Shonisova if she'd give her view on what happened.
Thank you very much. My role is to talk a little bit about the societal and intercommunal cooperation. And so where are we at the moment in Bosnia? How is the situation? And what are the main areas that we should tackle at the moment and we should focus on? So when we discussed the main lack of progress and the main sources of the lack of progress that we're seeing in Bosnia in terms of something that we here in the West call reconciliation, there are three things that I would like to highlight in the beginning, and then I would like to go into two main areas that we discuss as the main policy areas that we should concentrate on. Currently, Bosnia functions as a sort of three-in-one. So you would have a different perspective on the country coming from Sarajevo, a different perspective coming from Banja Luka as the main center of Bosnian Serbs, and then a different perspective coming from Mostar, from Bosnian Croats. And this is all mirrored at various levels of the country in terms of education, public services, infrastructure, and so on. But when we discussed what is potentially what was one of the main mistakes originally made in the immediate post-war years, it was our international focus on the support of an all-inclusive Bosnian identity and on the strive to recreate the multi-ethnic Bosnia that existed before the war. And what has basically happened was that, in many respects, this approach has backfired because Bosnian Serbs and Bosnian Croats have, in many respects, felt threatened by this all-inclusive Bosnian identity that was being imposed upon them. And they felt that this is coming from Sarajevo and this is meant to be a new Bosniak identity that was being created in Bosnia at the end of the 19th century, so to speak. So the main message in this respect would be we should be supporting the state, as James was saying before, rather than trying to recreate this all-inclusive Bosnian identity. And then we also talked a lot about these various structural obstacles that exist for people to be able to integrate and communicate with each other inter-ethnically. And that, as I said, is partially the fault of a divided infrastructure and many divided institutions. And education is one of the issues that often briefly discussed, but we also discuss it in terms of the societal impacts it has, where we have various national curricula and history, for example, is being taught in three different ways. So the main message in this respect would be that we should be supporting development of a social environment, also physically, spatially, which would allow people to integrate and communicate. So, for example, improve the overall infrastructure of the country. And then another aspect which I want to stress is something that we discussed at length and that actually pertains to all of the sessions, was that there is still a sense of threat among people. They still do feel threatened that potentially there could be a relapse of conflict and that violence is actually not out of the question. And this actually has serious consequences for how people act on an everyday basis. And we could see this during the February protests last year in 2014, when people stopped mobilizing and they felt threatened once the political elites instrumentalized media reports and spins that were coming out, threatening with new violence. And once violence erupted across the country, a lot of people stopped protesting and stopped being engaged because they felt that potentially another war was possible, although this was all instrumentalized politically and top-down. So I think in this respect, the main message would be to make sure that all of these various agendas and programs that we're now putting on table, regarding Bosnia, we need to make sure that we put the aspect of security and stability as an anchor as well. So we need to ensure that the local population feels that peace is secured and that there won't be any other relapse into violence. And so coming from this, we discussed two main areas that Bosnia needs major reforms in. The first one would be media and the second one would be civil society. In terms of media, of course, we all know that media is important to win the argument from the public and to win the public on the side we want them to be on, which is against some of the corrupt political elites in the country right now. And when we talk about Bosnia, it's especially the TV, and then also need to concentrate more on online media and internet education and empowering people by these means, because we could see during the protests how powerful social media actually was. The situation, the media situation in the country right now is not very rosy. Media are highly politicized, they're divided, they're fragmented, and they're captured by political elites. One of the media moguls, Fahrudin Radončić, owns the main newspapers, Dnevnija Vas, in Sarajevo. And of course, this is related to the fact that there's a high level of self-censorship, because journalists are not willing to report about high-profile cases. They are not willing to go into high-profile investigations. And this is not only because of the political entrenchment of the media, it's also because of the fact that there is a high scarcity of jobs, especially journalistic jobs, so they're not willing to lose their jobs. They also do not have incentives to actually investigate such high-profile cases because their salaries are so low, so they do not feel that actually, you know, it's worth it to go into the danger of being potentially physically attacked, which has happened in Bosnia recently, once they start poking around into some sensitive cases, so to speak. So the message here would be that we need to really, really more focus on supporting independent media, trainings of journalists, educate journalists in investigative reporting especially, and encourage the creation of an independent media scene, especially online media scene. The second area and the last area that I will end on is civil society. And when we talk about civil society, there has been a bit of a misunderstanding what civil society actually means in Bosnia. Immediately after the war, civil society was basically synonym to humanitarian aid. So a lot of people still look at civil society through the prism of humanitarian aid. They do not understand that it's actually a space, a sector, where anyone can get involved in. It was more like a dynamic relationship between a sender and a recipient rather than something that they can get engaged in. And similar to the media, civil society has been highly fragmented, not only inter-ethnically, but also intra-ethnically. We tend to forget that there is quite a high level of competition within the various ethnic groups for various reasons, for funding, for recognition of their victimhood status, and so on. This has also led to the fact that civil society and NGOs as such have had a very bad reputation in the country. Especially after the war, there has been a high proliferation of NGOs. A lot of international funding was spent on it, and a lot of these NGOs were set up only for the purposes of self-enrichment. So among the people, NGOs really do not have a very good reputation in terms of delivering whatever services or assistance that they should be. So we need to bear this in mind once we start supporting more and new NGO projects in the country. And so the main messages that we draw from these lessons were that we should try to streamline our support to good and apolitical non-governmental organizations in the country, organizations that have a good track record of what they've achieved. But we also need to focus on supporting local initiatives of especially young people and young organizations that are being created in the country, because these are the ones that are sometimes finding it very difficult to be able to enter the NGO market in the country, because they do not know the know-how, how to apply for very complicated, for example, EU projects and so on, and the funding competition is quite high. And the overall message I think that we gathered during the day was that apart from the fact that we need to focus on areas such as media, civil sector, education, and youth empowerment, we really need to start paying attention more to what the people actually want. And I think they have spoken out last year during the February 2014 protests across the country. And they have shown that they are able to be a partner that will change things in Bosnia, but they need our support. They are not able to take this further, which we saw last year, whereby they created so-called plena, where they tried to create something new, apolitical. They excluded the NGOs from this process. They tried to create something like a direct democracy in the country, but they have so far failed to take this further. And I think we have also failed to help them and assist them in this process. Ultimately, the political elites in Bosnia are worried about the people. They are worried about the public opinion. And I think this is something that we can use and we can work with. But ultimately, we also must not forget that Bosnia went through a genocide only 20 years ago. And any type of reconciliation, as we could see in Germany, can take 40, 50, 60, or 100 years. So also, we should not be too optimistic or too critical towards Bosnia on the one hand and on the other, because reconciliation needs a lot of time. So I think there is a lot of hope, and I think there is a lot to be achieved, but we need to bear all of these aspects in mind.
Thank you very much. And finally, Sir David Madden.
Thank you very much, and could I echo the thanks expressed to you, Lord Lovian, as our chairman today, and also to the essential Jacqueline, who works so hard on these events and puts them together so beautifully. My job on the 30th was to chair the final session, where we attempted to draw some recommendations, I would put it no more strongly than that, of areas where people should look if we want to make progress on Bosnia-Herzegovina. And it was a given, I think, for all people there that we did want to make progress and help the Bosnians-Herzegovinans to make progress. Obviously, the previous speakers have already covered quite a lot of the action points recommendations. I'll just go over my selection of what came out of the day. Obviously, the most important single item was the UK-German, now of course the EU initiative, for really putting forward a fresh approach to reform agenda in Bosnia-Herzegovina, but, and this is very important, without lowering the bar. It's really a sort of reordering of priorities, and I think the key priority there would be to get the stabilisation and association agreement implemented. And in particular, and in parentheses, don't get caught on the date, i.e. when might Bosnia-Herzegovina enter the EU. Look at the process. Look at how to make progress, which will be valuable in itself. The second main point, I think, at least for me, that came out of the day was the importance of NATO. Revive the good work of drawing Bosnia-Herzegovina closer to NATO. Richard gave an example, and so did James, of where NATO, of what NATO had managed to help to be done. Let's revive that. Let's make the membership action plan actually work in practice. Now, sort of underlying those two general points, there is the following thought in my mind, that, and obviously everyone in this room, we all know about negotiation and how you do negotiation. And we all know about accession into international organisations and what is required there. And we know that if you're going to accede to an organisation, you need to meet targets, you need to overcome hurdles. That's all very clear. And to do in both areas, the negotiation and the acceding, what is needed is political will. Again, that's absolutely clear. All I would add, though, is that in Bosnia-Herzegovina, it works slightly differently, because deliberately putting challenges or difficult issues on the table is actually a gift to potential spoilers, because these difficulties can be used against what you're trying to achieve. So I think we always need to be aware of this in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Don't make the hurdles too difficult, in particular when you know that the hurdles are difficult to surmount. We have to be flexible. And that, I think, is the importance of what is now the EU initiative. Richard mentioned the little slogan which came out, fix the region, fix Bosnia. Absolutely right. We have to continue to look at Bosnia-Herzegovina in a regional context. And this applies most clearly, I would have thought, in the NATO context. If you could create a virtuous cycle in which, say, first Montenegro were to join NATO, then Serbia, and then Bosnia, or even better, Serbia and Bosnia-Herzegovina at the same time, then you would have really pushed the real progress forward. And James, I think, mentioned the statistic. In Republika Srpska at the moment, support for NATO, 16%. If Serbia were to be in NATO or on the point of joining NATO, that figure rises to 70%. So you really get an enormous shift in opinion. The fourth of my sort of strategic points here is one which Jesse in particular mentioned, which is we should work more with civil society. Selectively, of course, not just any part of NGO, part of civil society, but those organisations which we, the international community, feel are doing good work, potentially good work. Let's help them make it a reality. I have sort of two sub-strategic points. One is, and it wasn't a word James used, but I'll use it now, subsidiarity, but I think it encapsulates what he was talking about, i.e. let's use subsidiarity, which after all works in the European Union and works in other EU member states, i.e. You can use subsidiarity and get things done without weakening central institutions. And the second point, and it's very much similar, in fact, I think, again, James mentioned this, allow Bosnian identity to develop without putting too much pressure. Pressure can be counterproductive. People can react badly on these very sensitive national and subnational issues. So use it selectively, but above all, allow identity to develop. And how do you do that? And I think all the previous speakers have referred to this. You work more with the states and you work more with the institutions. Strengthen the institutions, and that is another way of allowing subsidiarity to work well at an institutional level. Then I've got some tactical points, which I'll go through very, very quickly. One, clear messaging from the international community aimed at ordinary Bosnians. That's very important. Secondly, stress the positive. Let's talk up success. I think sometimes we're too willing to look at it and say, oh, it's terrible. It's bad. Actually, good things have been done. Other speakers have all referred to this. Let's talk it up. Use conditionality sparingly. I think this is for the reasons, partly for the reasons I referred to earlier. Use it sparingly, but name and shame as necessary. And when an earlier speaker was talking about conditionality, Adam Bennett, who's on my left, who used to work for the IMF, has passed me a note saying, IMF conditionality works. Well, I'm sure you're right, actually, Adam. Of course it does. I think we were talking about the broader, EU conditionality, NATO conditionality. Constitutional reform. Tackle it step by step. Defence sector reform is a very, very good example of constitutional reform, which was achieved by a careful and nicely tabulated process. Trade-offs. Again, this goes back to what James was saying. Trade-offs intended to reduce the overinflated number of institutions in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Paring down where you can without damaging. I think that's probably all I want to say until I come to three final points, which are the following ones. I think there was a general agreement in the workshop, yes, that the situation was bad and that there was a risk of it getting worse. So let's use this as an opportunity. Let's use it as an attempt to get back to the days when things were done, when things were achieved, and the international community and the Bosnian Herzegovinans worked together to achieve things and move forward. And I think I'm sure it's not by chance that we have Paddy Ashton speaking at our lunchtime today, and no doubt he will tell us what he thinks about, the past and the present. Okay, we gave the workshop the title, New International Thinking. Was there any? Well, I think it's the normal yes and no in response to that. Yes, I think there was new international thinking in the sense of there was a vision of where resolve, unity and focus could actually get us. No new specific elements perhaps on the table. We're still EU and NATO is what the game is all about. But there are specifics there. There's a stabilisation association agreement. There's the membership action plan. These things need to be better used and they need to be implemented. So my conclusion from it all is the perfect quotation from Gramsci. Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. I used this first in a Cyprus context many years ago, but it seems to me to be absolutely spot on. And actually, it's been the watchword for diplomats over the years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I think we've had an excellent presentation from our panelists, and certainly we've had a very comprehensive workshop on this particular day.